The Other Side of the Sky. First published in Infinity Science Fiction Magazine, the September-October issue, 1957. Collected in The Other Side of the Sky.
The success of the earlier set of linked short stories, Venture to the Moon, led to the writing of this series, which by good luck appeared on the London newsstands just when Sputnik 1 appeared in the sky.
Special Delivery. I can still remember the excitement back in 1957 when Russia launched the first artificial satellites and managed to hang a few pounds of instruments up here above the atmosphere. Of course, I was only a kid at the time, but I went out in the evening like everyone else trying to spot those little magnesium spheres as they zipped through the twilight sky hundreds of miles above my head. It's strange to think that some of them are still there, but that now they're below me, and I'd have to look down toward Earth if I wanted to see them. Yes, a lot has happened in the last 40 years, and sometimes I'm afraid that you people down on Earth take the space stations for granted, forgetting the skill and science and courage that went to make them. How often do you stop to think that all your long-distance phone calls and most of your TV programs are routed through one or the other of the satellites? And how often do you give any credit to the meteorologists up here for the fact that the weather forecasts are no longer the joke they were to our grandfathers, but are dead accurate 99% of the time? Whew, it was a rugged life back in the 70s when I went up to work on the outer stations. They were being rushed into operation to open up the millions of new TV and radio circuits, which would be available as soon as we had transmitters out in space that could beam programs to anywhere on the globe. The first artificial satellites had been very close to Earth, but the three stations forming the great triangle of the relay chain had to be 22,000 miles up, spaced equally around the equator. At this altitude, and at no other, they would take exactly a day to go around their orbit, and so would stay poised forever over the same spot on the turning Earth. In my time, I've worked on all three of the stations, but my first tour of duty was aboard Relay 2. That's almost exactly over Entebbe, Uganda, and provides service for Europe, Africa, and most of Asia. Today, it's a huge structure, hundreds of yards across, beaming thousands of simultaneous programs down to the hemisphere beneath, as it carries the radio traffic of half the world. But when I saw it for the first time from the port of the ferry rocket that carried me up to orbit, it looked like a junk pile adrift in space. Prefabricated parts were floating around in hopeless confusion, and it seemed impossible that any order could ever emerge from this chaos. Accommodation for the technical staff and assembling crews was primitive, consisting of a few unserviceable ferry rockets that had been stripped of everything except air purifiers. The Hulks, we christened them. Each man had just enough room for himself and a couple of cubic feet of personal belongings. There was a fine irony in the fact that we were living in the midst of infinite space and hadn't room to swing a cat. It was a great day when we heard that the first pressurized living quarters were on their way up to us, complete with needle jet shower baths that would operate even here, where water, like everything else, had no weight. Unless you've lived aboard an overcrowded spaceship, you won't appreciate what that meant. We could throw away our damp sponges and feel really clean at last. Nor were the showers the only luxury promised us. On the way up from Earth was an inflatable lounge, spacious enough to hold no fewer than 8 people, a microfilm library, a magnetic billiard table, lightweight chess sets, and similar novelties for bored spacemen. The very thought of all these comforts made our cramped life in the hulks seem quite unendurable, even though we were being paid about $1,000 a week to endure it. Starting from the second refueling zone, 2,000 miles above the Earth, the eagerly awaited ferry rocket would take about 6 hours to climb up to us with its precious cargo. I was off duty at the time and stationed myself at the telescope where I'd spent most of my scanty leisure. It was impossible to grow tired of exploring the great world hanging there in space beside us. With the highest power of the telescope, one seemed to be only a few miles above the surface. When there were no clouds and the seeing was good, objects the size of a small house were easily visible. I had never been to Africa, but I grew to know it well while I was off duty in Station 2. You may not believe this, but I've often spotted elephants moving across the plains, and the immense herds of zebras and antelopes were easy to see as they flowed back and forth like living tides on the great reservations. But my favorite spectacle was the dawn, coming up over the mountains in the heart of the continent. The line of sunlight would come sweeping across the Indian Ocean, and the new day would extinguish the tiny, twinkling galaxies of the cities shining in the darkness below me. Long before the sun had reached the lowlands around them, the peaks of Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya would be blazing in the dawn, brilliant stars still surrounded by the night. As the sun rose higher, the day would march swiftly down their slopes, and the valleys would fill with light. Earth would then be, at its first quarter, waxing toward full. 12 hours later, I would see the reverse process as the same mountains caught the last rays of the setting sun. They would blaze for a little while in the narrow belt of twilight. Then Earth would spin into darkness, and night would fall upon Africa. It was not the beauty of the terrestrial globe I was concerned with now. Indeed, I was not even looking at Earth, but at the fierce blue-white star high above the western edge of the planet's disk. The automatic freighter was eclipsed in Earth's shadow. What I was seeing was the incandescent flare of its rockets as they drove it up on its 20,000-mile climb. I had watched ships ascending to us so often that I knew every stage of their maneuver by heart, so when the rockets didn't wink out but continued to burn steadily, I knew within seconds that something was wrong. In sick, helpless fury, I watched all our longed-for comforts, and worse still, our mail, moving faster and faster along the unintended orbit. The freighter's autopilot had jammed. Had there been a human pilot aboard, he could have overridden the controls and cut the motor, but now all the fuel that should have driven the ferry on its two-way trip was being burned in one continuous blast of power. By the time the fuel tanks had emptied, and that distant star had flickered and died in the field of my telescope, the tracking stations had confirmed what I already knew. The freighter was moving far too fast for Earth's gravity to recapture it. Indeed, it was heading into the cosmic wilderness beyond Pluto. It took a long time for morale to recover, and it only made matters worse when someone in the computing section worked out the future history of our errant freighter. You see, nothing is ever really lost in space. Once you've calculated its orbit, you know where it is until the end of eternity. As we watched our lounge, our library, our games, our mail receding to the far horizons of the solar system, we knew that it would all come back one day, in perfect condition. If we have a ship standing by, it will be easy to intercept it the second time it comes around the sun, quite early in the spring of the year AD 15,862.